Hello and welcome. The Portavoot Institute for the Study of the Iranian World welcomes you to another episode of our podcast, Legacies of Ancient Persia. Join us as we further explore the many legacies of ancient Persia and its relevance to global patrimony. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Legacies of Ancient Persia. This week, our guest is Dr. Lara Fabian, a professor of Iranian archaeology at UCLA. In this episode, we discuss how she came to archaeology from a solid career outside of academia, the unique linguistic challenges when studying Iran and the Caucasus, tackling problems of Iron Age chronology, and understanding the true definition of the study of archaeology. We hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like what you hear, please give our show a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. Been really looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, me too. This is really exciting.
Yeah. So I wanted to start you off with what I hope is just a really simple question, right? And that's, how did you get into the field of Iranian studies?
You know, I think a lot of people get into archaeology. So I'm an archaeologist, right? Like my primary, let's call it like scholarly identity, is as an archaeologist of the first millennium BC into the first millennium CE in the broader Iranian world. So in the Iranian heartland, but also in the fringe areas that really were not fringes, right? They were centers in their own right, but whatever, we'll get to that later. As a lot of archaeologists, I think I got into archaeology because it's a wonderful combination of something incredibly physical. You're studying in a way, in a very tangible way, the remains of people's lives from thousands of years ago. And at the same time, it's also something that we do in libraries. It's a book research thing. And so I love this combination of the tangible, of studying the physical world, but doing that in an intellectual way. I actually had a career before I got into academia, which was as a theatrical scenic painter and scenic designer. I went to school for this, and I worked in New York, and I, you know, worked as an assistant designer in studios where I built like little tiny scale models of Broadway shows and things like this. And it was a wonderful career. It was a wonderful way to spend my early 20s. I loved it. But as one often does in the course of one's life, one realizes that maybe the thing you picked that you wanted to do when you were 16, 17, maybe it doesn't offer the full scope of what you want to be doing when you're 30 or 40 or 50 or 60. I'm not there yet, but, you know. And so I decided to go back to college, go to college, normal college for the first time. I had been at art school, but that's a very different experience, when I was in my mid-20s. And I was living in New York doing theater. And I decided to just start taking some classes at Hunter College. It was accessible. It was in the city. Tuition on a per credit basis was quite cheap. So it was like low bar to entry. And my first class was an ancient Greek class. And it was taught by this woman who had been the chair of the classics department, Tamara Green, for I think like 35 years at that point. I mean, it was just, and this woman, and you know, I didn't understand this, right? I'm a part-time student sitting in an evening ancient Greek class, right? The chair of the department taught that evening ancient Greek class. And she did it because she liked teaching the first year Greek students partly. I mean, right? Like this was like, it was something that was important to her. And I remember, and I'm not going to say the whole thing because some of it is like actually so, like it's so personally affecting for me that if I go too deep into this, like it's going to make me emotional. But I remember what that woman said to us on our first day of class. And it was about her own intellectual journey. It was about why she loved teaching and working at Hunter College. And I had no way of imagining that I was going to get a PhD, that I was going to end up being a professor myself. But I found it so exciting and inspiring. And again, like at this point, I really wasn't thinking about grad school. I wasn't thinking about being an archaeologist. I didn't really even think that that was a thing that one did. But what she said on that first day of class in this like little windowless classroom on the sixth floor, seventh floor of Hunter West made me think about my future in a different way, right? It made me think about the potential of education, about the opportunities that you have over the course of your life in a different way. So I took this class. It was the only class I was taking. And there were a bunch of students in the class who studied with this professor who they really loved, Professor Cole. And he taught archaeology, and they just sort of loved his classes. And they would always talk about how great his classes were. So of course, when the next semester came, I was like, well, I should also sign up for one of those classes. Like, that sounds fun. And by this point, I had decided I was actually going to go back to college, right? So I'd started with one class, and the next semester I was taking a normal college class load, course load. And I took his class. I don't remember which one of it was one. I ended up taking many, many survey of archaeology classes with him. And it was a great class. It was about sort of material culture of, I guess it was probably like the intro sequence, right? Which is like some survey of ancient material culture, probably like ancient Mesopotamian or Turkish, like ancient Anatolian archaeology or something. And that man would just stand in front of the class and lecture. Without, I mean, he had some like handwritten notes, but basically not. And he would give these incredibly encyclopedic lectures about Bronze Age and Iron Age archaeology. And I was totally, totally hooked on it. And so I sort of through from that point on started gently playing around with the idea of like, oh, maybe this is something you can study. Like maybe you can do more with this. And I did. And eventually that led to grad school. And I found myself very early in grad school working on a field project in Azerbaijan that one of my faculty members at the University of Pennsylvania was running. And I was at that point working mostly in the Mediterranean world, sort of on Roman material culture. That was what I had done as an undergrad. And you start grad school and you don't really know what you're going to do, right? Like you're sort of a partially formed, and I was coming right out of a BA, out of an undergrad degree. So I went to Azerbaijan with her in the summer, and her project works on much earlier material than what I now focus on. But I remember going to a museum near where the site that we worked at was, and just being astonished by the amount of what at that time I would have classified as Mediterranean material culture that was in this museum. I mean, Roman coins, Syrian glass, stuff that's just like really typical for the Mediterranean world. And I couldn't explain it, right? And I was like a first year grad student. So to a certain extent, you don't actually know that much at that point. So it's fair that I couldn't explain it. But I went back to the university after the summer, and I started looking through books. And I, at this point, spoke some Russian, so I could look through both Western European literature and to a certain extent, some of the Russian literature as well. And what I found was not a satisfying explanation for how this particular part of the world, the South Caucasus, fit into a broader picture of antiquity that I had in my head. And on an explicit level, like, yeah, you can explain why there are Roman coins, near the Aras River. Like, that's actually an explicable fact. There's been research on it. It's not like nobody knows it. It's not like it's a new discovery. But on a broader level, when I started reading about this region, about the South Caucasus, I realized that I didn't have a way of placing it in my perception of antiquity. And that was really the thing that got me started in this region. And as soon as you start working in this region, what you realize, so the South Caucasus is, we're talking about this little isthmus of land. It's between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. And it connects northern Mesopotamia and Iran and Anatolia to the Eurasian steppe. There's a big mountain range that goes across it in the north, the Greater Caucasus. There are a bunch of mountain ranges that run all through the South Caucasus, from actually Turkey, from the Zagros, and then through into Iran, into sorry, the Taros in Turkey, and then through into Iran in the Zagros. And as soon as you start working seriously in the South Caucasus, you realize very quickly that you are in a Persianate space, right? You're part of the Iranicate world in this territory. And so at that point, then, like, that was my introduction. That was my backdoor introduction to the Iranian world and to the material culture of the space.
I love it. I think our audience will definitely appreciate it because everyone comes into it differently. And if, I mean, I've been podcasting for many years now, and there's not one path. So I do appreciate people who had a very different experience instead of the conventional is fine too. Look, I went through a sort of more conventional one, but I think it's more exciting to hear about the people whose experience is a little different. So I love that. That's awesome. But also because that seems to be touching on a lot of different points and places in the world. So, what languages did you have to learn to even figure that out?
Yeah, I mean, this is so, look, the languages question, and it comes up all the time in Iranian studies, right? It comes up if you want to be a philologist working or as a historian working on this space, right? It comes up in a different way for archaeologists. So my core research languages for my dissertation research, interestingly and unsurprisingly, right, knowledge production about the past occurs within political structures in the present or in whatever present was studying that particular past. So for the South Caucasus, a lot of the knowledge production, the early knowledge production, was written in Russian. It was written by both Russian colonial officers who were working in the space in the course of the 1800s as the South Caucasus came to be part of the Russian Empire. And then eventually, and especially in the Soviet period, it became the lingua franca for scientific communication for everybody working within Soviet space. So Russian is actually the most important research language from a historical perspective, if you're looking at sort of the deep history of research that has been conducted in the South Caucasus. There has always been a tradition of publication of scholarly research in the languages of the South Caucasus, so in Georgian, Armenian, and Azerbaijani. The degree to which scholarship has been published in those languages historically has varied, and it's also been different between the three countries. One thing that challenges research in this space is that not only does each of these three countries have their own national language, but actually those languages are from three different language families. Georgian is a Kartvelian language. It's not part of the Indo-European language family. It's actually an isolate. It's related to basically three other languages that are all spoken in either the modern region of Georgia or part of Turkey, or sort of some of the mountainous Caucasus. Armenian is an Indo-European language, and Azerbaijani is Turkic. And so you have three languages that are from fundamentally different language families, which for researchers really is like it's a real complication for working in this zone. Then on top of that, obviously, anytime you're working with archaeology, with Iranian archaeology, you have to pay attention to the voluminous work that's been done by our colleagues working inside of Iran, particularly over the course of the last several decades when the political conditions have made it difficult for Anglo-American and Western European academics to be in that space. So you have to be paying attention to the work that's been written in Persian. And that's the modern languages, right? Those are the languages that you're going to be reading the archaeological literature in. But if you want to then go and talk about historical sources, then you are talking about a whole nother vast set of languages. For the period that I work in, which is, I call it often the most broadly the Achaemenid through Sasanian periods, but often sort of like the kind of like that the post-Achaemenid, right? Like the Hellenistic, which is this like interregnum period when putatively foreigners were controlling this territory, except like they actually weren't, right? Like most of the dynasts were actually local dynasts, whatever, we can get into that more. So from the Achaemenid through the Sasanian period, if you want to cover all of the languages, like nobody can do it. Actually, there are very few people ever who have lived who would have those language skills, and certainly most of us don't today. We have significant bodies of administrative texts, not from the region specifically, but from the broader region in various Aramaics. We have inscriptions from the South Caucasus from this period in Latin and Greek, certainly, also Aramaic. There's a lot of literary evidence, textual evidence that was written in the Greco-Latin traditions. There is some material from later Sasanian literary traditions that speaks back about the past. There's also a ton of stuff in, although its historicity, so like its specific factiness is a little bit difficult to access, but there's a lot of stuff in the medieval Georgian and Armenian chronicle traditions that speak back about the ancient pasts of the South Caucasus. So yeah, it's a linguistic challenge, this space. And it's something that it's not, it's frankly, it's not just a challenge for people who, like, it's a challenge for anybody who researches in this region, because there's just literally, like, there's not a human on the planet who really has all of those resources to begin with. So.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it sounds like the most successful person might have to be a hyper polyglot. I remember being so jealous growing up because there was a friend in high school who, by the time we both graduated from undergrad, this person legitimately had 12 languages. 12. And they were like, I'm not stopping until I get to 20. And I was like, I don't know how your brain can. And you know, when people say they're like a hyper polyglot, you're kind of like, okay, but is it like you do Duolingo on like five of the languages? And so that's kind of the level. And this person, no, like fully conversant in almost, I mean, not all 12, but like most of them. So I was like, unless you're one of those special people who can do that, then yeah, I feel like it'll be hard. But it's interesting because just as I was thinking about, you know, there's so much research coming from all these different places, and to try to, you know, research them kind of in context with each other, it would be hard because you can't possibly learn all the languages. So having, I was just at the Society for Classical Studies conference in early January. And I remember thinking, oh, well, this is great because it's a space where, you know, almost everything was either like something about Rome, blah, 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 something about Greece. Cool, not a lot of. There was like one panel that had somebody doing like Babylonian and one panel on Persia. And so I'm curious, like for Iranian studies, because it was such a large ancient empire and you really could have anyone running the gamut from I'm more over here in the Mediterranean to I'm all the way over here in India. Like, does that make conferences kind of hard if you have so many different regions and all the languages? And how do you like go around and do all the things?
I mean, it's an interesting conceptual question, right? Which is, it's kind of a question about what the canon is, right? When we think about a discipline like classical studies, that isn't an incredibly strongly developed canon. And it, in fact, is a canon that, like, it exemplifies what we think of as a canon, a selection of texts that have come down to us that have been edited in such a way that they sit on your shelf in the green editions and the red editions, and you know, you have your lobes or whatever. We don't have a canon for Iranian studies in the same way. I also, and I do not, I have to be careful with how I frame this because it can sound a little bit nihilistic if I'm not careful. I'm not sure that it's a problem that we don't have a canon. I think that we live in an age where we have increasingly realized, we've come to understand how limiting the canon can be. And if you think about the canon, let's take, because you're talking about the AIS, like let's take that canon. Anybody who works in classical studies, right? Any of our colleagues who teach in a classics department in 2024 will tell you that that canon, that those things, the lobes, that they're, first of all, a fraction of what we actually, well, they're a mega fraction of what existed, but they're actually a fraction of what we have. You know, that is not everything that we have from the ancient world. It's the stuff that comes down in a significant way that has been digested in a particular way, that has been acculturated inside of academic circles. But there are so many other texts out there. There are so many other types of text out there. And increasingly, or let me frame this differently. One of the challenges for disciplines like classical studies, I think, in 2024, is frankly how to break past the canon and how to create, you know, new expansive visions of their discipline that incorporate other bodies of evidence. We, in Iranian studies, we have a different problem, but maybe we should not frame it as a problem, right? And that is that we don't have a canon. And that when you do research in this space, it's a little bit more of a choose your own adventure. And that can be dangerous, right? Because that creates a lot of space for sloppiness. It creates a lot of space for cherry picking. It creates a lot of space for one-sided stories, right? Because you pick this body of evidence and not that. And there's a plausible deniability to it all, because how can you possibly know all, you know, it's all so diverse. On the other hand, we do find ourselves in a moment of sort of like, and I don't mean this in a casual way, in postmodern history telling. How do we tell history? How do we talk about the past in a sufficient, in a way that is sufficiently complicated to capture what we now understand to have been these incredibly complicated interwoven realities? And for that project, I'm not sure that it's a problem that we don't have this super hard center of balance. But I think we, as a discipline, and those of us who work in this space, we have to really grapple with what that means. And we have to be aware of, and this is the thing that I was talking about when we just started talking about languages in the space. We have to be aware that, you know, knowledge isn't neutral, right? Knowledge comes to us through particular ways of knowing particular intellectual traditions. And one of the things that makes Iran interesting, but that you see in places like the South Caucasus or in Central Asia even more clearly, is that these are spaces that have been studied by very, very different conceptual lenses. And that goes all the way back to antiquity, right? So we talk about what languages do we need to know to understand, what ancient languages do we need to know? And I've named a whole bunch, I said about Aramaic, and I should have said also, Old Persian and blah, 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 blah. But you know what else we need? Like, we need people who know classical Chinese to work on this, right? Because the Shiji has a lot to say about Chinese-Persian relationships. For example, to name just the most famous of those texts, of those transmitted texts from the Chinese tradition. So we have to be aware that going all the way back to antiquity, a lot of different people were engaging with this space, were thinking about how to form their political relationships, were reflecting various types of political realities in their texts. And that's continued in the modern era. The scholarship that was produced in the tradition of Soviet Iranian studies, such as it was, is very different than the material that was produced by Germans doing Iranistic or Americans at their departments. Each of these has, and that is to say nothing of material that was produced inside of the Iranian national tradition, which has its own perspective. So all of these various historical traditions for studying this space, they contribute to what we understand about it today. And it's a huge ask of researchers, and it's a huge ask, especially of young researchers who are just finding their feet, to grapple with all of these levels of complexity. And it makes me a little bit jealous of some of our colleagues, right, who have more confined axes of complexity. But it's also the great promise of the discipline. I mean, it's also the thing that makes it so exciting and so inspiring to work in the space.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I mean, that brings up so much. And it's true. I love the way you made sure to frame it as well, just because it's true. I think one of the things that I got into many discussions at SES this year with colleagues, right, is, how do we sort of expand beyond the bounds of what we have? I mean, there was a whole panel on kind of like expanding canon when talking about pedagogy in the classrooms. And, one of the things I even brought up in one of the Q&As was like what we consider foundational, where some of the texts and some of the people that we teach, they're so problematic. So we're like, why are they still considered canon to being taught? But also then I think I asked somebody and I just said, when's the last time you saw somebody like Martin Bernal really cited and used and taught? And someone was like, I don't know. I mean, a while ago. And I was like, well, maybe we should rethink because things have changed. And so, yeah, it's a really interesting framing.
Yeah. And like, look, it's also, the Bernal question and this idea of a discipline like classical studies and what we can learn from that. One of the things that I think we need to learn is just to take seriously the diversity of thought about this space. And so I keep thinking of other perspectives on these questions that I haven't mentioned yet. And, the other obvious one that comes up in this is the South Asian component to all of this, which is something that very often goes under-mentioned in studies of ancient Iran and its, neighborhood, right? But like, that is a space that is also profoundly intertwined and entangled with all of this. And, this is what I was saying. Like, it's like, if your classical studies, and I hate to keep picking on them, but we're talking about the AISCS, so like, fair enough. You have to keep positioning yourselves against or with respect to a couple of key touchstone debates about how broad the ancient world was and how we can conceive of it. For us in Iranian studies, we haven't had quite the same like crystallizing moments. And so in a certain sense, what we have to do is almost anticipate those things, right? We have to try to very self-consciously position ourselves within this broader network to take advantage of the richness of those perspectives.
Yeah, no, for sure. And yeah, I'll move on past picking on poor SES. It was just top of my mind because as we were talking about the languages and I realized like it really was kind of one-dimensional and that we didn't really, we had some panels that talked a little bit about expanding, but also when looking at all the other panels in context, they're all working off of the exact same
things. And so I was like, oh, that's so interesting that, you know, you're talking about coming from a field where that's, it's not so set. And so you do have a little more freedom to kind of figure it out. And so it makes it also just kind of really exciting, but also more challenging because, yeah, you can pick the languages. It's not so, you know, one notey of, do you want Greek or Latin? What a great big selection, you know? So you're like, oh, okay. So,
yeah, you know, and I think, you know, the metaphor that I use all the time with talking about the way that I understand our work as archaeologists and historians working in this space is, I think a lot of people who are not academically involved in these types of enterprises think that what we do is to use this metaphor that there's a puzzle, right? That one, a puzzle of the ancient world. And it's missing a bunch of pieces, or like a bunch of pieces fell out of the puzzle. And our job as historians, as archaeologists, is to go and find those little pieces of the puzzle and stick them in. And if you just find all the pieces, you know, it's like a Pokemon thing, like collect them all, put them in the puzzle, and then like you'll have the ancient world, right? You'll know it. And I think that part of where this perception comes from, and I don't think that this is what people who work on other regions of the world really do either. I mean, I don't think this is what historians do, but part of the perception, the reason why we have this perception problem, is that so often academic research does look like just sort of like going and picking up like one little piece of minutia and fitting it into this or that. But when we work with spaces like the South Caucasus, like Iran more broadly, these spaces that have been studied from such different perspectives, these spaces that have been part of such different historical narratives, right? There's not one map. There's not one puzzle to put back together. You can't fit the pieces back because they never came out of one piece. They never came out of one entire whole representation. And so our challenge is not to put those pieces back together. It's to take the pieces that we have and create some new whole out of them. And that whole is always going to be just one representation. It's not the real puzzle of the past. It's one way of putting the pieces together sensibly, in a logical way, in a defensible way, in a way that we can cite and argue about, right? This is critical. Like, we have to make it so that the knowledge that we produce, that people who come after us, that our colleagues can push back and can say, well, like, I'm okay with that, but I'm not okay with that. So these are the types of arguments that we have to be making. But what we need to know, and what we need to be better about communicating, frankly, is that that thing that we've just made, it's not the accurate picture of some imagined ancient past. It's a way, it's a lens for us to talk about that past based on our best understandings. And this is actually something that I think is quite unique about the space of Iranian studies. The more different perspectives that have historically had purchase on these questions, that have historically looked at these questions and considered them from their own intellectual angles, the more complicated it is to fit those pieces together. Because very often they're based on different ideas of what the past was and what the past means and what the past can mean. So, you know, you can take simple things, like the most basic things about Iranian world in the period that I studied. Who are the Parthians? What are the Parthians, right? And how do the Parthians relate to the Arsacids, right? And there's, on one hand, like a very clear academic definition, right? The Arsacids are a dynasty, the Parthians are an ethnos. But when you start to dig at this question of who the Parthians are and how we define it, you find this range of answers that is so frustratingly different that it almost stymies your ability to even put them in a row and talk about each one next to the next, because they're fundamentally predicated on different ideas of how we understand who peoples are, right? Are we talking about something ancient? Are we talking about some deep character of the Parthians as nomadic people that goes back to a deep, you know, is that what we're talking about? Are we talking about where they geographically come from? Are we talking about what languages they speak? The fact that so many different people have looked at these questions from these very, very different perspectives means that you have to keep all of that in your head when you construct your own story. And I think that that's one of the central difficulties of all of this, right? That it's not just that you have to keep a whole bunch of languages in your head, because, you know, you can learn languages, right? It takes a long time, but they're learnable. But it's that you have to keep this incredibly complicated set of perspectives about the past in your head. And that's not just true about historical facts. It's true about material culture as well, right? material culture is just as subject in different ways, but it's just as subject to these various interpretive frameworks as historical facts, quote unquote, are. So yeah, all of this makes the space frustrating and fantastic and sort of exactly where I think we should be focusing our attention because of that, right?
Yeah, for sure. Well, speaking of, I love the puzzle analogy, but so speaking a little of your slice of the puzzle or the pie or whatever analogy you want to go with, you've done work right with the Iron Age. And it dawned on me that, like, when I speak with people, you know, people are, for some reason, maybe it should be obvious to me, but maybe not. But for some reason, I'm like, okay, there's a slice of people who are just like, oh, I'm a Bronze Age person. Obviously, we like talking about Bronze Age collapse and this, that, and the other thing. Or you'll go later in time. I don't really think I talk to a lot of people who do Iron Age. So for other people who are like, oh, well, that sounds different. What was it about the Iron Age? Like, what kinds of things are going on in the Iron Age that make it so interesting for you to study?
Well, so, you know, part of this question of what we call ourselves, it's also a question of how disciplines have traditionally defined and cut up the research. And the Iron Age, or let's call it the Long Iron Age, right? Because like the Iron Age in the regions that I work in, depends on whose chronology you look at, but like you can get into the first centuries CE and still be in the Iron Age in some of these spaces, according to some chronologies. The thing that I'm interested in, and this is something that I think is a truism, it's a truism for archaeology in general, but it's also something that we still need to restate and reinforce when we talk about this, is that especially as we begin to talk about this age of empires and these rises and falls of these huge super-regional entities, the majority of material culture, the majority of cultural production is local. It's not happening inside of an explicitly trans-regional, transnational set of metaphors. It might have transnational connections. It might have very, very broad connections. But the actual material culture production, it is generally a more local set of material with some objects than moving and starting to move faster and starting to move across much more vast ideas, and not just objects, but also ideas and people and all of this, right? But the reason for emphasizing sort of this Iron Age thing in the research that I do, or in the way that I talk about my research, is to emphasize that there's a lot of continuity, right? Because what choice do I have? Should I start calling the material from the 5th century BC Southern Caucasus Mountains? Are we going to call that Achaemenid? It was part of the Achaemenid Empire. You know, it was. Is that the best term that we can put on the material culture for that region? How much of the material culture is identifiably Achaemenid? Some of it is incredibly, right? I mean, some of the best Achaemenid palaces that we have come from the northern reaches of the Southern Caucasus, from along the Kura River in Georgia and Azerbaijan. I mean, there are phenomenal, and dare I use this word, canonically Achaemenid structures up on that river. But at the same time, when you talk about the archaeological material that you're finding, I prefer to use terminology that's not quite as pegged to the imperial chronologies, especially in spaces where maybe our full understanding of the reach of those empires remains relatively vague. And this becomes even more of a problem in a certain sense when we get into the what we would call sort of the Hellenistic and then Parthian Roman periods. Because again, in the South Caucasus, I mean, certainly in the Hellenistic period, okay, what do we mean when we say Hellenistic? Hellenistic is a contested, problematic word. It is at once speaking about culture and also speaking about temporality. So, okay, let's then not use the word Hellenistic. Let's talk about Hellenistic period. Fine, that still has some connotation of Greekishness. But, you know, how Hellenistic were the various polities that started to consolidate in the South Caucasus in this period? How Hellenistic, if we use the word Hellenistic, how Hellenistic are the Seleucids, right? Are this like, should we see the Seleucids as a fundamentally Greek thing that comes into Iran, or should we see them as something that are they rather something that is heavily influenced by Iran? What about when we get to Central Asia? You know, so these terms that are pegged to imperial chronologies are challenging for archaeologists to use. especially for those of us who are working with like non-imperial material contexts. If you're digging a capital city, fine. Call it in a Achaemenid royal city. Call it, you know, a Seleucid capital. But if you're digging a little tiny rural settlement on a plain somewhere, or, you know, in the Central Asian oasis landscape, like just using these imperial words, these imperial chronologies, it's a statement about what you think those people were doing. And that's the wrong logical direction. We have to look at their material culture. We have to look at what we understand of the history, and then understand how they fit into these super regional settings. So in a way, I use the term Iron Age to talk about, you know, a lot of these same periods that other people are talking about it, but to talk about it and to make very clear that some of the a priori assessments about how this fits into political systems are maybe not quite as clear as we think they are. And I also want to be super explicit here that I don't mean that they shouldn't become clear, right? Like, we have to understand how these broader systems functioned. It's not good enough to go and dig up a bunch of jars from a bunch of little villages and then say like, oh, there were jars there. Like, of course there were jars there. There are jars everywhere. People need to hold water and they need to hold food. They make jars. You know, our job is about understanding lived experience of people in these spaces, and over time about understanding systems through that lived experience. But like, there's a process of inference there that starts with the material and then ends with maybe some larger historical conclusions.
No, I love how you definitely laid that out. I think it's really helpful to have that kind of frame of reference in mind, because I think also fundamentally, like, for those especially who don't work in these fields or adjacent to them, you know, I don't think people are as easily able to really sort of make that distinction for sure. Even I, right? And I was trained as a classicist all through undergrad, sometimes make a silly mistake and I'll think about the history of something, but I'll have my sort of more, you know, historiographic lens on and not so much of the material stuff. And I'm like, well, that's because I wasn't trained as an archaeologist. But as you're talking, it also dawned on me, and I can't believe I hadn't thought of it before, but we have an archaeologist with us, so maybe it's just your influence. But I think there's a misconception about what archaeology kind of is. And I realized this because I was having a conversation just the other day with someone, and it was for research I was doing for an article I'm writing. And I just kind of asked someone like, hey, okay, well, can you tell me what's archaeology? And, you know, this person is not connected to the field at all. And they gave me an answer that was like so not accurate, but also like it was still kind of right enough that I couldn't be like, that's not right. But I was also like, but how do I tell you that that's not right? So it was a really interesting thing. So based on the fact that if I asked a random person, you know, do you know what the actual definition, like, what is archaeology? So as an archaeologist, can you help actually tell us what it is?
Yeah, so absolutely. But before I do that, there's an important like little bit of backstory to give here, right? So I talked at the beginning of today of this discussion that we've been having, sort of the way that intellectual history shapes our understanding of the South Caucasus and of Iran. And I think it's really important to do that. I also think that when we're talking about things that maybe we think we understand better, that we also need to be very clear about talking about how intellectual history has shaped them. So in the case of archaeology, we have to be extraordinarily explicit here. We're talking about a discipline that is rooted in two major strands of, or maybe three, it depends a little bit on how you define them, but there are a handful of core archaeologies that have been practiced for several hundred years that have developed into what we now do as archaeologists. And it's not an illustrious history, right? We're talking on the one hand about sort of traditional classical archaeology, maybe some biblical archaeology material, where we essentially have a set of texts and we want to find material culture that demonstrates something that we see in the texts already. So we want to find the evidence that such and such a Roman author was, you know, really telling the truth about what happened to Carthage, for example. On the other hand, we have archaeology as it's been practiced in outside of these historical contexts, and particularly in some really exploitative ways with indigenous communities in North America and in the Americas, but also across the world, right, where we have archaeology that's about going and sort of looking for primitive pasts, And the discipline has moved way beyond those things, but they're embedded in the core, in the sort of marrow of the thing. And all of us who practice this discipline need to be very aware of just where that, those problems come from. So archaeology, as I understand it and as I practice it, is basically using the lens of material culture, so of physical things. And material culture is a very expansive term. It includes things that people make, like pots and houses, but it also includes things that people use, like bone tools and, you know, sort of archaeobotanical data. So using that material, plus all of the other type of data that we can gather from excavations to understand how people in the past lived. And this issue of people is absolutely central, right? We are not looking to create typologies of ancient vases for the sake of creating typologies of ancient vases. We are interested, the type of archaeology that I practice is interested in how people were interacting with their world, with their built environment, but also with their landscapes and with each other, with their peer communities. And archaeology is a discipline that specializes in using the physical world in its all its various forms and the traces of that physical world that come down to us to play that game of trying to piece together the past. And that makes it a discipline that can play really well with disciplines like history, right? Which is using a different set of data to try and answer some of the same questions. But it has its own theoretical center of balance because there's a couple of extra leaps of inference that you have to make as an archaeologist, because you have to get from the physical object to an interpretation of it. So a text is already an interpretation, like the in a different way than a physical object is. I'm not saying that there aren't interpretive problems with working with texts, but it's a different set of issues. And, you know, archaeology also takes lots of different forms. We have people who do landscape archaeology. We have people who do, you know, bioanthropology and who look at human remains. We have people who look at seeds and zooarchaeology, animal bones. And our job as archaeologists is to take all of these different pieces of data and use them to construct hypotheses that answer questions that we have about the past. And ideally, those questions, and for archaeologists who work in the time that I work in and that many of my colleagues who work on these types of questions work in, you know, these are questions that are connected to these big issues of cultural development in the period, right? So like, how are local communities responding to these growing empires that are sort of spreading across? How are communities responding to environmental pressures, to population pressures, to conflict, which is also something that we tend to see in periods of imperial expansion, right? And we then use these incredibly granular traces of human behavior from the past, because that's what all of this is, right? All of the evidence that we use is some type of little flicker of some person in the ancient past having made a decision to make a pot a certain way or to build a city in a certain place. Although nobody ever really decided, very rarely did anybody ever decide, like, today I'm going to build a city in this place, right? Usually this is the process of many thousands of decisions. But that's what we look at. Those are the traces that we work with as archaeologists.
No, that's super, super helpful. And I guess just to boil that wonderful answer down for people who are like, I want the too long didn't read version.
Yeah.
I guess, let's call it that. So almost succinctly, though, we could sort of categorize archaeology, right, as just the general study of the ancient and recent human past through material remains, any material remains. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, the classical term is archaeology is the discipline of things. And we've expanded that. And I think it's important to put a little footnote on that, right? Because some of the most interesting things that we study today are things like human environment interaction, right? Like how it's not exactly a tangible thing, but it does leave traces. So archaeology is the use of visible material traces from the past to understand past human behavior.
Great. Well, I'm going to take that and put that somewhere so I remember. And if people ask, they'll have a nice succinct little TLDR version.
A TLDR version. Yep.
Exactly. So one of the things that I find fascinating that I love about that as well is, and having not, I sort of tapped the discipline, tapped the beast in college, as I called it, but didn't ever really get to go into it. And I'm a little sad because I would have liked to go into it deeper. So I'm hoping that for me and for our audience, you might be able to just do a quick explanation, but, you know, I remember in a very basic summary or something in undergrad, how they talk a lot about provenience and provenience issues in archaeology. And how sometimes, you know, it can lead to false assumptions about a certain object or something. But as you were talking about human interaction with things and how it's, you know, it doesn't have to just be, oh, there's a votive statue here. Let's look at the painting. So with that kind of in mind and how it's changing, can you just tell people quickly, what is provenience and why is it important? What does it mean? And how does that really shape and affect, especially the stuff you're doing, since you're looking at such like a wide area, and for people who are also trying to like do that kind of time period and the geographical region?
Yeah. So provenience is it's the term that we use for talking about where an object comes from. And we tend, as in today's world, conflict ridden as it is in many of the regions that we study, politically unstable over the course of many decades, which, for the record, and this is something that needs to be said anytime we talk about things in this context, which has had far greater consequences on modern communities living in these places than it does for any of us researching the past, right? Like this stuff that we do working with material culture from the ancient past, it can look from the outside as though the thing that's at the center is these objects. And we have to be explicit as archaeologists in saying, as soon as we start talking about these problems, we have to talk about the people who are living in spaces today and what consequences have been had for their lives. So provenience, we tend to talk about in the terms of unprovenienced objects, which is a polite way for talking about material where we don't know where it came from, archaeological material where we don't know where it came from. And the reason that this relates to this issue of instability and conflict is that a lot of the unprovenienced objects that we have come to us through black market art processes, illegal excavations, things that tend to happen in periods of political instability, in places that have economic difficulties where people can make money by excavating and selling antiquities. And also important to note, right? Why do they make money doing that? They make money doing that because people in countries where there is money are buying these things. So it's a two-sided process. There are a lot of pull factors that are pulling material. Unprovenienced objects, there are many unprovenienced objects that are unprovenienced simply because they were excavated a really long time ago and nobody kept a good record of where they come from. But there are also many unprovenienced objects that are unprovenienced because they have been illegally excavated according to international law and also often according to national law. Those unprovenienced objects, from a straight archaeological perspective, art historians can do a lot with them. Sometimes archaeologists can too, but from a raw archaeological perspective, they are worthless. 100% worthless, because archaeology is about objects in context. It's about knowing where things come from, knowing what they were related to. So you can have the most beautiful, I don't know what, piece of silver plate. You know, Sasanian silver plate is a super common object type. There's a lot of it, and a lot of it is unprovenienced. And you can do art historical work with it. You can study it. You can, you know, depending on your ethical tastes, some people prefer not to work with this. Some people have a rule against working with this. Some institutions have rules against working with this. But you can theoretically make something out of it on that level. But archaeologically, you really can't. Because if you don't know where it comes from, you don't know its context. And if you don't know its context, it kind of doesn't tell a story for us anymore. It doesn't tell the type of story that we tell as archaeologists.
Yeah, I mean, those are really great points. And, you know, I hope that people who listen to this will also maybe have a bigger, better appreciation for when we do get things and we find them sort of hopefully relatively close to how or where they would have originally been employed. Because if not, it's cool to say, hey, we have this thing. But if I don't know anything about it and can't figure it out, then it's kind of a sad dead end. And it feels like archaeology has the potential to have a lot of frustrating kind of dead ends when you're like, oh, I have a thing. It looks nice and I can tell you what it is, but nothing else. Does it get frustrating for you to kind of sometimes feel like, oh, I can't find the thing and I want to know this thing and now help, I can't?
I mean, I think that the study of any type of a distant past is filled with these holes that you're never going to be able to fill, right? There's so many questions that we can't answer. I think I would say it this way. I have a lot of my personal patience level, my personal tolerance for things that we can't know about for good reasons is pretty high, right? There are all sorts of good reasons why we can't know something. I work a lot with coins, and a lot of the coins that I work with were found in hoards in the early 20th century across southern Russia, in the Black Sea region, in the South Caucasus. And at the time when these coins were found, it was standard practice to describe the hoard in a certain way to maybe keep some records, but then you'd break up the hoard, you'd sell it, pieces would go here and there. We don't have good find spots recorded. We don't have good, and you know, what are you gonna say? Like, I wish that they treated archaeological material in 1903 the way we do today. I mean, yeah, I kind of do, but like that's information that's lost and there's no point in being angry about it. And I don't find it that frustrating. I find it an interesting intellectual challenge. How can we work with this material? How can you make this useful? What I do find frustrating is the current, the ongoing destruction to countries' cultural heritage through like illicit activities and looting and purchasing of antiquities. Like that is frustrating because that is not, you know, something that happened 150 years ago that you can't really control for. That's stuff that has to do with like modern behavior and frankly, like irresponsibility of an international marketplace that continues to allow for this, you know, sale, although often under various auspices of illegal material.
Yeah, for sure. You know, everything we've been talking about has been so interesting. And one of the things that keeps coming up to me is just, there's so much just about kind of for everything from like the time period to the location of what you do. Obviously, there's so much more. It's hard to, you know, there's a reason it's impossible for any one person to do it all as much as we wish we could. And one of the things I'm wondering that I hope we can, you know, point our audience to is if they're interested in the kinds of things you look at and learning more about archaeology, specifically Iranian archaeology, which, as we've established, is all the way from Greece all the way into Asia. So like it's huge. And so What are some of the resources that we can point people toward if they're like, I love this conversation, but I want to know more and go deeper?
Yeah, you know, it's really hard. So this is actually a hard question to answer because we in the field of Iranian studies, but to a certain extent, actually in a lot of archaeology outside of a couple of really big hotspots, we have not been as good as we should be about making our material accessible to people. And this is a little bit confusing because people love archaeology, right? Like, you know, I meet people all the time in my life in social situations and casually who, you know, come to me and say, oh, did you see that article about the new runes that they found and, or, you know, like runic inscriptions that they found? And did you see, like, people are really attracted to the stuff, but you know, it's hard to get your head around. What I would say is this: some of the resources that are being worked on through Port of Wood at the University of California, Los Angeles, are really, really excellent. The Gazetteer, and I know you talked to Ali Mousavi recently, but like that is a wonderful project. And I really encourage people, even people who think like, man, I don't know, like this looks kind of technical, like go and just scroll through at like pick a random site and go on a little journey with it. They have amazing material. So that's the first thing. The second thing that I would say is that a lot of academic texts are not as intimidating as people remember them being from when they first encountered them as an undergraduate. And a lot more is available online these days. There's still lots of paywalls. It's annoying if you're not a university community member and you don't have login, or if you're working, as many of my colleagues do, in countries where institutions don't have access to, you know, fancy subscription-based journals. But actually, like academia.edu, I mean, it has its problems, but there is a wonderful body of material on there. And so I would encourage people who might be interested, who might have heard interviews here, to actually not shy away from some of the harder core academic stuff and to really just like go and start reading things and see what pops up, see what's interesting. And this is also something that, you know, I think it can be intimidating to read these types of academic texts. But once you start doing it, you actually realize that most of them are easier to manage than you maybe think they're going to be. But that's not a super satisfying answer, right? Because the answer that I wish I could give is like, well, go and look at like whatever this great project about, but we don't really live in that world right now. You know, there's great outreach like this podcast. And there are, I know you've sort of talked about other podcasts that deal with the ancient world and with the ancient Iranian world specifically. But it's really hard for me to name like a specific place where people should just go here. And if you were to ask me this question for the South Caucasus, I would have even more difficulty, right? Because they're like, oh man, I'm sorry. It's gonna be a hard fight to learn, right? But we have better access to information than we've ever had on a global, like on a global level. There is more information out there that can be accessed. And I think that really the best thing to do is to encourage people to not be afraid of going out and finding some of that, you know, as academic-y as it might be.
Oh, for sure. I tell people all the time, I know it can seem intimidating and scary. And honestly, I have this conversation with my own family. Like I somehow ended up being the only like ancient history person in my whole family. Everyone else is either like a doctor or into music or something. And so they're like, I don't know. It's very funny. They're all like, that's awesome. We love that you're into ancient history. We don't know where this came from. Not us. So I was like, it's okay. I'll explain it all to you. But, you know, I did. Even when I was going to the conference, you know, I was trying to explain some of the panels and ideas, and half my family, their eyes, I could tell they kind of glazed over on through. And of course, I could see this through the FaceTime screen. So I was like, wow, you must really not understand. But I was like, it's hard, but like, it's worth it, right?
So look, I mean, I also think that there's, I you know, I listened to your conversation that you had with Layla several weeks ago about her work with video games. And I think, you know, there's space for all of these various types of engagement with this material. And I don't think there's a one size fits all answer. And I think it's in a certain sense, like, you know, to say, here's the one best resource, go here, everybody go here, is kind of to flatten out the diversity of what people want to get out of their engagement with this material. And I think in my own postmodern way, more on team, like, no, like let's live with that complexity a little bit. And like, let's say, you know, video games can be an amazing way of engaging, and not a simple way. Like, it's not like, oh, well, like, if you want the serious stuff, go read academic prose. And, you know, if you just want to be goofy, go play your video game. Like, that's not what I'm saying here. There are lots of different avenues into this. And those avenues need to relate to what we as individuals, as actual humans, me as a human, how I like to get information and how I like to see the world. I would also encourage people to think about museums as a place for really high quality information. Museums have a lot of problems. There are ethical problems surrounding museums. There are collection history problems. But they're also confronting a lot of those problems in really interesting ways. And they are much better at communicating than those of us who sit. I mean, I think we're pretty good at communicating when we're teaching classes, but we're not always good at communicating. And academics, we're not always good at communicating in the rest of our professional lives. But museums, like, that's what they do, right? So people should really think about looking for local museums, even if they don't actually, you know, even if they don't have a lot of Iranian material, for example. We're very lucky in LA, you know, to have some museums that have better collections of ancient material, certainly. But people should look for local museums that can give access to things like, how do we study the past through material, right? House museums are great, like historical museums of earlier American history can be so interesting. And all of the principles of how you study those periods of history and how you study ancient history, it's the same set of principles from an archaeological perspective.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's so... Oh, I love everything about this. Yeah, it's true. Museums, yeah, they despite all the ethical, interesting things that arise with them, they do. And you know, it's always interesting how I do tend to ask friends of mine, hey, when you travel, do you go to museums? Do you carve out the time? Like, what do you get out of it? How long do you spend in any given? And I don't know why, but I find it fascinating when I have friends who are like,
yeah,
oh, I just kind of walk through the gallery and what I see is what I see. And then I've walked through and I'm done. And then I have the people who, you know, they're like, oh, I went up and I spent like 5 minutes in front of each thing, reading everything. And I'm like, wow, you're dedicated. Because I think anyone who's been to a museum, especially a big one, knows they're great, but you get so tired.
Yeah. So, I mean, but on that point of tiredness and also like, where do you focus? I also want to give a shout out to, I mean, it's really unfortunate that this word in English has acquired this connotation of sort of something stuffy, but like a lot of museums have great docent programs of people who do tours, of people of like Some, you know, sometimes they're free, sometimes you have to pay extra for them. I mean, everybody now has like audio guide tours or cell phone. You should look at tour podcast-ish tours that you can download ahead of time for museums. But actually, like, the live museum educators at a lot of museums are phenomenal. And so, you know, you can just go and like look for when the tours are at a museum that you're interested in going to. And those can often be a really great way, especially if you're not a person who like loves museums, of figuring out how to engage differently with museum material. When I was a graduate student, I did some development of tours for the Penn Museum, which was affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania. And it was really a fun educational question. Like, how do you, like, I did a tour that was about like various ways that women show up in the museum, right? So it was like women in the archaeological past, but also like female excavators of sites and all of this. And it was just like a, for me as a graduate student, it was a wonderful experience to think about public communication. But it also made me just think about and pay more attention to how many other things like that there are out there at museums.
Yeah, well, I hope. Well, I will keep that in mind for sure. I do love museums. I'm that crazy person who every time I would go to a new place, I would have to factor into my very long, extensive travel schedules. And I'd block off like 5 hour periods for just like museum. And of course, anyone who travels with me, I feel very sorry for them, kind of, because I'm like, I'm going to drag you to a museum. Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe you don't have to come, but like I will be there for 5 hours. So yeah, but yeah, I love museums. But anyway, I could ask you so many more questions, but that would take us forever. And I think you and I would get very tired and have to sleep eventually. So I will refrain from doing so. And instead, I will ask you two final questions, which I like to end the show with.
Interested in learning more about the wonders of ancient Persia? Visit the UCLA Archaeological Gazetteer of Iran. The Gazetteer digitally preserves famous locations, World Heritage sites, and lesser-known areas from all time periods of ancient Iranian history. You can explore using the interactive map, or visit the encyclopedic catalog for updates to the ever-growing list of archaeological sites. Visit www.irangazetteer.ucla.edu and learn more about what the Archaeological Gazetteer of Iran has to offer.
The first one is, what, in your opinion, is the greatest legacy left to us from ancient Persia?
Yeah, so, you know, I did my research before I came on your podcast, and I listened to a bunch of the episodes. Actually, I listened to pretty much all of the episodes that you've recorded, which was a really wonderful way about hearing what some of my colleagues are doing in the field, and I enjoyed it a lot. And I was thinking, as I was listening to them, and this question sort of crystallized, and I was like, oh, she's going to ask me this question. And, you know, the first thing that I want to say is that I loved everybody's answers. And every single answer that every single person gave, I thought to myself, like, oh yeah, that's like, I need to build off of that one. Like, you know, like, and a lot of people had the same struggle, right? Which is that, in a sense, and you yourself imply this in the name of the podcast, right? It's not the legacy of ancient Persia, it's the legacies of ancient Persia. It's this incredibly multifaceted thing. And so I wanted to start by acknowledging the brilliance of your guests and the other people who are going through this struggle of how you can try and possibly wrap your head around this, and say that for me, very personally, the legacy for me is this legacy of interpretive challenge. I love that we have in the space of pre-Islamic Iran a space that is so profoundly difficult to wrangle into some type of meaning. I think that that is absolutely the most healthy thing for us as academics to be confronted with. And I don't think it's an accident. I published a review of a book once where I talked about the idea of prismatic perspectives on ancient Persia, that somehow there's something about the space that invites this incredible complexity, this narrative complexity. And I think that that's true. And, you know, we can be facile about it and say it's geographic. We could go a more poetic direction, and we could talk about, I think it was Ali Mousavi who talked about Iranian culture sort of sucking things into it. We could go a historical direction and talk, as Leila did, about all of the amazing history that's been created, in literature and art that's been created in this space. We could talk about archaeology and material culture. I think Catherine Lynch talked about sort of like the artifacts. So we could go all of those different directions, but like what I want to say is that it's actually all of those things, right? And it's not all of those things in the sense of each of them individually. It's all of them together. And it's the fact that what pre-Islamic Iranian studies leaves to us is a terrible complexity. And instead of sort of picking one strand of that complexity, I want to say like, that's the legacy and that's the one I really like.
Yeah, well, I love it. Also, I just very much appreciate that you actually like and listen to our show and get a lot out of it. It's always gratifying to hear.
It's wonderful.
Then if you've been an avid listener, then I assume you're already...
I know the second question.
You know what's coming. So yeah, what do you think would be the best legacy that we ourselves can leave for future students of Iranian studies?
Yeah. So, you know, funnily, like this one's almost harder. Right? Because the question about legacies is a personal question, right? It's a question about how I interpret this, how I take this on. The question about what we should be leaving for our students, it's difficult. What I want to say as I was thinking this over is actually something we've already talked about or touched on in this interview, which is that in order to do this project, this thing that we're trying to do now, we need to be good at collaboration and we need to make resources available. But collaboration doesn't happen. Collaboration requires infrastructure. And our job as people who are in positions in this discipline where we have access to resources, where we have the ability to start conversations, is, I think, to create the infrastructure of collaboration. And this infrastructure is one that needs to reach our colleagues working in Iran, working in Central Asia, working in Uzbekistan, working in the South Caucasus, working in Russia. It's one that needs to reach our institutional colleagues at other schools. It's one that needs to reach our disciplinary colleagues working in places like classics. And I think that the best thing that we can do, and this also goes back to this idea of like, what do you do if you're a discipline that's unencumbered by having a canon, right? How do you use your energy? And I think one of the ways that we can use our energy is we can skip over the step where we each went into our little silos and we said like, all right, like we're gonna categorize and classify all of this. I think we can skip that step. We've learned that that step is maybe not, I mean, it's important. You have to be rigorous about the research that you do. But I mean, we do that on our own. And what we do together, we should really be doing together. And so the legacy that we can leave is a legacy of collaborative spaces focused on the Iranicate, the broader Iranian world. And I think that has to be our job.
Well, I certainly agree. I think it's great. And again, as you probably know, both of these questions were designed to not be easy and not have one answer. And I do like how at the end, it kind of shows off the individual personalities and kind of the leanings of, you know, what scholars in the field today and up and coming scholars are thinking. And like, you know, I think the public kind of wants to know too, because they're like, well, so yeah, no, I love that answer. And I did kind of lie because there is one last question I will ask you.
Okay, what's that?
That is, where can people find you on the big scary thing that is the internet?
Yeah, so the best place to find me is actually through UCLA. And I try to be good about putting as much of my publication record as I can without publishers getting angry at me and sending mean letters online. So much of my research has been published under open access publishing rules or is outside of the sort of time limits. So I have a bunch of stuff on the UCLA website. I unfortunately share the name with a Belgian singer. So if you Google my name, you will find a lot of things about a Belgian singer who's fairly famous. So my name plus UCLA, and you will end up at the Near Eastern Languages and Cultures Department website.
Sounds good. Well, that's kind of fun. At least you can say I share a name with a famous singer.
In the early days of the internet, I used to get email for her on my personal email address. And like that has not happened in a very long time. But occasionally I will like, I don't remember when the last time, it happens to me actually more in the South Caucasus, but occasionally I will show up at something and people will be like, oh, we thought that somehow the singer was also an archaeologist. And I'm like, no, I'm sorry. I was not on like, yeah, no, that's not me. Apologies.
Oh, that's great. Wait, I love that so much. So, and then if I remember correctly, I saw floating around somewhere, you also have an academia page, right?
I do have an academia. Yeah. So the UCLA stuff sort of redirects to academia, but I do have an academia page, and academia can be fun because you can search Like once you start clicking on one person's papers, it'll feed you other things that are like it. So for people who want to go and stumble around a little bit in this world, that's a great place to do it.
Great. Well, I will make sure those things are linked. So if people would like to ask you questions about anything, they can. And since we do have you here at UCLA and teaching, and we are very excited and happy to have you here, can you quickly just tell people, you know, what are you teaching now that you're here?
So this year so far, I have taught an undergraduate survey of the archaeology of Iran, which went from the very, very earliest days. So we started with Neolithic stuff and we went through the Sasanian period. I taught a more focused graduate seminar on the same material. So that was starting in the Middle Elamite period and then running through. And, you know, you sort of have to like, this is this issue of continuity, right? Like, even though most of the students in that class were interested in later periods, if you don't understand the Elamites, you don't understand the Achaemenids. So that was an archaeology survey that was focused on sort of special topics. And we were looking at relationships between Iran and its neighbors. Iran, however, redefine it in these different times because it gets defined very differently. Right now, I'm teaching a graduate seminar on water in Iran and Southwest Asia. So looking at both theories of hydrological infrastructure and the relationship between hydrology, hydrological control, and state formation. And then also like all of the other things that water does. So water's role in religion, water's legal structures, legal systems surrounding water. And then next quarter, I'm going to be teaching an Iranian history survey undergrad lecture, but subject to TBD, still working on that syllabus. I have a bunch of really cool ideas, but I'm trying to figure out which is the right one to do right now.
Nice. Well, for anyone who is at UCLA who may be listening to this, these sound like some really great courses, and I'm going to recommend highly that you take them because they sound great, and you need to take them because I can't. So with that, I'm going to just, you know, thank you once again for coming and joining me on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lexi. This was really fun.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully you will come back and join us at some other time.
I will certainly look forward to the opportunity to do that.
Legacies of Ancient Persia is a Portavood podcast production hosted and edited by Lexi Henning, with select episodes co-hosted by Marissa Stevens. Cover art provided by Hadley Leesman and original music by Brent Arhart. Established in 2017 as the premier research center for the study of ancient Iran, the mission of the Portavood Institute for the Study of the Iranian World is to engage in transformative research on all aspects of Iranian antiquity, including its reception in the medieval and modern periods, by expanding on the traditional domains of old Iranian studies and promoting cross-cultural and interdisciplinary scholarship. Thanks for listening to our show. It's available to stream on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow us on social media at Portavood Institute and at Portavood UCLA, or visit our website, portavood.ucla.edu. If you enjoyed today's episode, please give us a 5-star rating and review us. For podcast inquiries or questions about the Portavood Institute, please email us at portavoodpodcastproduction@gmail.com. We'll see you next time as we continue our deep dive into the legacies of ancient Persia.